Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 4:13, and we're going to continue with a statement that the Apostle Paul also referred to in terms of the ministry, and obviously it's applicable to many things, because that's the law of Jesus Christ, the law of God, that the laborer is worthy of his hire, whoever that laborer is, and even that is applicable to the laborers, if you can call them that, that were mentioned at the end of the chapter, last chapter, in terms of the poor, of the widow, of the orphan, of the stranger, you see, who are commanded, in essence, by God, that if they want to eat, they should go to work. You see, and how did they go to work in those days? Well, he commanded his people Israel, to whom he had given lands, to leave a little bit of the produce behind. So the poor, those who are disadvantaged, those who are either homeless or landless or poor or whatever it may be, you know, if it is a widow and an orphan, obviously you're talking about one person missing the family, the father or the husband, you see. And so somebody who died is going to leave a widow behind and children, and both of them, these two categories, are going to be disadvantaged financially. And so God takes care of that. And it's not as you find in the society, unfortunately. And so when we read also in chapter 25 about the ox, as you read here, you shall not muzzle the ox when he treads out the corn, or he too falls into that category. He works, he deserves to eat. You know, as Christ would say again, the laborer is worthy of his hire. If the ox is working, why shouldn't he eat also? In other words, don't use people as machines. Don't use animals as machines. You see? And do not allow anybody in your society who are in a disadvantaged state financially, you see, don't allow them to live a life of total indignities, you see, poverty. You know, if they're willing to go and do some kind of work, even if the work means just coming to pick up some of the produce left behind by you, it's still nevertheless work. You know, they have to get out of the house, get dressed, walk over to your field, wherever it is, and get what they need there, whatever you're left behind. In other words, everybody works. You see, all the creatures that God created in order to eat, even the parasites, think about it, even the parasites that God created, you know, to climb on your apple or your fruit or whatever it may be, they have to go to work in order to eat. You see, they cannot stay home and, you know, deliver it to them. And so it's important to look at these statements of God as you meditate on them day and night. You begin to see a world of wisdom behind it, and love and concern and compassion, and so much thinking that goes behind every single law that God gives His people. And that is a reflection of His mind, of His nature, of His character. And so in essence, this law, the ox, and the law previously before that, to make the Israelites leave something behind so the poor can come and pick it up, that's in essence a law in terms of human beings against parasites. You see, that's in two-legged form, parasites. Because there are a lot of people, unfortunately, out there. And that's why the Apostle Paul, you know, also reflecting this mind of Christ, is in essence talking about people who are busybodies. Instead of going to work, you know, they just go from place to place, lazy. And so he made a statement very plainly, you know, the person who doesn't work shouldn't eat. You see, if he's not willing to do even those kind of things, and of course he's talking in terms of the city way of life, you know, you don't necessarily have fields and farmers in the city, but at least, you know, there are people who always need help. And if somebody is in a condition or jobless or whatever it may be, has no business of his own, he should go around into the market and take care of his own family. And that's why I said that people like that who do not take care of their own families within the body of Christ are worse than infidels, unbelievers, publicans, you see. God does not want anybody to be a lazy bum. And unfortunately, society produces this kind of people, and they become parasites. And so, you know, this law here tells you an awful lot of what God wants among His people, the way they should behave when they are in whatever condition in life. If they are rich, they should be, you know, willing not of their own, you know, good heart, but by commandment of God, you see, and also out of love, because all they do is just because of the goodness of their own heart, you know, they were just going for a show off and they want to be patted on the back, you know, they contributed, they did this and that and the other thing. Now, all that would become meaningless to God. It's all in vain. That's what the chapter of love is all about. As Paul was saying, you know, though I give all my money to the poor, if it's not done out of love, he said, it's all nothing. There would be no credit for it. And yet, the overwhelming majority of the world, the philanthropists of this world, and all of us do-gooders, you know, when we give, you see, we want to have a receipt for it, donations, so we can declare it, you know, tax-wise, and get some money out of it. And so we can have our plaque on the wall, so we can have our name, you know, mentioned in the paper here and there, on the radio, on TV. And people do it in public, and they don't realize that's contrary to the law of God that said, you know, let not your right hand know what your left hand is doing. You see, you do it in secret, and the Heavenly Father is going to reward you in the open. And so many laws are attached to this, about the ox, and also about the other laws that we just read earlier. And that's the way God wants it. You see, He told Adam, in the sweat of your brow, you shall eat bread. So it's not just a curse. You see, for jobless people, that's a blessing if you can find a job. You see, and some people look at it, on it only as a curse, you know. Just imagine, you know, if you were Adam, even though you have to go to work now, instead of being the garden of Eden, we had to do nothing. Well, in essence, he was like a parasite there. You know, he just did nothing. Just all he had to do, extend his hand and pick up, pluck a fruit, and that was it. And God says, now you got to go to work for it. You got to sweat. A lot of people, you know, are very happy to go sweat in order to get, something to feed the family with and take care of themselves. You see, so it's not just a curse. It's a blessing, too. It's a great blessing. But it's also a command. You want to eat, in essence, he tells Adam. You see, before that, I worked, I planted the garden, and you ate. And now, you go work, and whatever you produce, it's going to be yours. So nobody's going to take it away from you, you know, minus the tithe that you give me, you know, sacrifices, offerings, whatever it may be. You see? And this is what you see here, you know, and encompassed within the statement of the ox and also within the others. So let's understand that. Also in terms of the way God thinks, that God does not want His people, if they fall into this kind of conditions, financial hardships, to lose their dignity. The dignity of the family does not want them to become parasites, does not want them to get lazy. You see? He wants them to be people with respect, self-respect, and He wants others also to show them respect. And so the person that God commands, when you leave something behind, you'd not think, well, you know, I'm better than that person. Look at me, you know, I'm such a good person. I'll leave it behind, and he comes, and, you know, that's not his. And he just comes over here, and I let him out of the goodness of my heart eat, you see. And God said, no, don't treat them like that. They're your brothers and sisters. You see, if not for the grace of God, you too would have been in their condition. It can happen to you. It can happen to anybody. And so you treat them with honor and respect in the process. You can develop relationships with them. And to begin with, they probably are your relatives. Because the only people that lived around you in that society were your own relatives. You see, so move beside the strangers. And that promotes affection, love and compassion and mercy and kindness and respect and dignity and honor within the family. You do not have a welfare mentality. You do not have disrespect and dishonor there. You see? God does not want that. And yet, you know, that's unfortunately what the welfare system is all about nowadays, not only in this country, but in every place, all around the earth. People just sit home and get their check, and then, you know, they go to the store and buy whatever they need to, and their kids see it, and so they grow up to be like that, and, you know, you find second, third generation sometimes welfare people, welfare mentality. God despises that. You see, you got to do something. You got to do something for it. And that's why, you know, recently, you know, the government, that is in the former administration, they came up with this policy. You got to give those people dignity and respect and honor and put them to work. Even if they don't make much, at least they work and they feel good about it. You see? And obviously, if they've done it God's way, you know, they would not make just a little bit with a barely making it, you see, and still are in poverty, or maybe above poverty, but they would have had plenty for them without shame. Because after all, God is the God of all and is the Father of all and does not want any of His children, you see, just because they're not doing as well financially, He does not want any of their, you know, of His children to go in nakedness or in shame or in indignity or in poverty. And if we looked upon, you know, that from God's point of view as the Father of us all and look upon ourselves as His children, all of us, not just some of us, you know, we would have loved the law of God, we would have walked in it, and nobody on this earth would have been in the condition where they are today. Well, you basically have a society where very few have plenty and abundance and overabundance, so much that they don't even know what to do with it. And many get into mischief because of that, just like all the people of Sodom and Gomorrah, because they had so much, their territory looked like the Garden of Eden, you see. And others are in terrible poverty and shame, and they are generally the overwhelming majority of planet Earth, you see. Now, that's a horrible crime in the sight of God. And those of us who have plenty, oftentimes, are responsible for it. Not always, you know. If you go to work and make good money and all that, it's not your fault that somebody in Bangladesh is poor. You see, but what it means is that, generally speaking, all those around you, you should take care of them. And this should not be in absolute shame and poverty and contribute to the cycle of poverty and crime. Anyway, this is what the law is talking about here. Now, obviously, there is so much you can talk about every tiny little law that God gave, big one, small one, in between. And that's the purpose of every single one of us, to meditate and study the law of God day and night. This is just, in essence, an overview. You know, some of you may think that it is a profound and deep overview, and it's not. It's very shallow in comparison to what there is in it, you see. It's not the intent here to give you everything that we know, just to bring you to the point where you desire, when you hunger, when you thirst for righteousness, and even if you do, then you're going to be filled, you see, by God, not by men. You see, through His Holy Spirit, when you dig into it yourself. Now, this is, in essence, just a shallow overview, tip of the iceberg of the study of the law. And so we continue here with verse 4, as again Moses says, and Paul, as I mentioned, speaks about that in terms of the ministry, but that's applicable to anything, anybody, anyone. If you enjoy the labor of somebody, let them, you know, have some benefit from it, be it an ox, be it, you know, an organization, a group, whatever it may be. You shall not muzzle the ox when he treads out the corn. If brethren dwell together, that's another law, and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not be married abroad. Well, abroad means she shouldn't go outside of the family. And unto one not of his kin. And that's obviously in the society that God created to begin with. Brothers did live together, you see, because all families got a piece of land, you know, then the father, you know, divided that among the children, and they all lived together. So that's the way basically it. But, you know, God is foreseeing also a future where people are not going to be necessarily staying in the same condition. So you find the law in this stated in this way. If brethren dwell together, generally for a long time they did. But when the time came when they did not, this law is still applicable. Because otherwise you think about ramifications. Well, if they happen not to live together, you know, let's say one moved to another country or another town, another village, another district, whatever it may be, and for whatever is the reason, well, God does not want to, in this case, to impose it on him, you know, to come all the way back there and marry his brother's sister. That is his brother's wife, you know, which is his sister or his sister-in-law. And so that's the way, you know, the law is stated. Sometimes, you know, when you read those things, you have to think, why is it stated that way? You see? And you begin to gain more knowledge and information about it. And so, if brethren dwell together, and one of them die, and have no child, which happens, the wife of the dead shall not be married abroad, unto one of his kin, in other words, outside of the family. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. And that's the law of God. But you know, it worked both ways. At least, you know, I can talk about that from a personal experience, because my own case, my mother was murdered when I was about 4 years old by Arabs. That's before the establishment of the State of Israel, actually around the same time. And my aunt, which was my mother's younger sister, well, that was the custom of the time when a sister gets married, you know, she's got children, a lot of burden, so a younger sister moves in and helps. Well, it just worked out naturally. My mother died, and her sister, which is my aunt, and I call her aunt to this very day, became also my mother, you know, stepmother, that is, the wife of my father. And so I have a brother and a sister from her, and she is my aunt, and she is my stepmother, and my brother and sister are my brother and sister, but they're also my cousins, you see, because she's my aunt. So anyway, it works both ways. In this case, you know, only one side of the family is mentioned here, but basically people used it both ways. Keep it within the family. In other words, this way you take care of the same family, and if there are children, you know, you take care of the children too. And so this is what we read here. This is the law of God. But it's not a law of God that God says you better do it or else. You see, he still gave the people an option. But in that case, there is going to be a little shame attached to it if a person is not willing to do it. A social stigma. Verse 6, and it shall be that the firstborn that she bears shall succeed in the name of his brother that is dead. And that's the whole intent of the matter. So he's going to have a seed left after him, who is named after him, who is going to receive his property, you see, and to God that was very important, and so he keeps the genealogy within the family. Even though he's not necessarily exactly his, you see, but he becomes adopted by him even though he's dead, and he carries his name. And so a lot of people do it to this very day. Even in naming names, you know, giving names to children, they give it after, you know, deceased husband, father, brother, whatever it may be, to carry their name, as they call it, you know, to carry his candle on. And so he says, this is the way it should be done. And, you know, the firstborn that she bears shall succeed in the name of his brother that obviously, the firstborn could be a girl sometimes, you know, preferably they would rather have a boy, but, you know, it could be a girl. So she carries the name of the family. And then, you know, if there is a boy after that, well, he carries the name of the family. And mind you, in those days, they did not have last name. As a matter of fact, I don't have last name myself. You know, Joseph is not my last name. That's the name of my great-grandfather. You see, my name is Mordecai, son of Judah, son of Jacob, son of, you know, so forth. People didn't have their last name, but they carried the name of the father. That's why he could be called son of David even 10, you know, generations later. That's what they mean by that. And so, this is what he's saying here. He shall carry the name of his brother that is dead. Why? So that his name be not blotted out of Israel. Because when that happens, when somebody's name was blotted out of Israel, that meant a horrible curse. You see? Just like, say, God said about Amalek, which we're going to read about very soon. Or God says, I shall blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. That's the worst thing, you know, you can do to a people, to a person. And so, if somebody died before he has children, if nobody's called, you know, being called after him, that's a terrible shame. And so God wanted to take care of that, remedy that problem, and that's why he commanded that and gave that law. So it shows you an awful lot about the love of God, the concern of God, the kindness and the mercy of God. And when you think about all these things, all the treasures that are in the law of God that reveal the nature, the mind, the very personality and character of God, you know, that's Jesus Christ. That's the Father. You know, both of them are the same in nature and character. And for people to say, you know, the law is done away with, you see, it shows, you know, the insanity that is in those kind of minds who are utterly, utterly in darkness and in ignorance because they do not even know to begin with, even though they call themselves Christians, that he is the God of Israel, that he is the husband of Israel, that he is the one speaking to Moses. He is the one that gave this law. You see? That's what happens when people are in utter darkness and they think they are in the light, and that's why, you know, God says to Isaiah, woe unto them that call darkness light and light darkness, and uncall good evil and evil good. And that's basically where the majority of those who think that they are the people of God are. And so this is what God is saying here. And if the man like not to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate unto the elders. You know, the gate of the city, that's where they go after work, and you know the elders are going to be there, and other people are going to be there also. The priest is going to be there, the Levites. You see, that was in essence the place of congregation. That's where the synagogue was. That's where they taught the law. That's where judgments were being passed. So it's you know, it's a generic name for a lot of things that later on became institutionalized when bureaucracy sets, you know, took hold, that is, of the nation, and then they began to build buildings and have officers, and you know, government moved in, all that. But basically, in the beginning, it was a very simple thing. It just went to the beginning, you know, the beginning of the city, you know, the gate into the city, and all things, you know, were taken care of there. So this is where she goes, and she shall say, my husband's brother refuses to raise unto his brother a name in Israel. So first, she's talking about her husband, and then he's got a brother, and he's unwilling to raise, you know, to perform his duty and to maintain the name of his brother, you know, raise unto him a name in Israel. In other words, he's becoming partaker in the total decimation of the memory of his brother, and that's a horrible thing to do, you see. So not many people did that, obviously. And that was, in essence, the intent that God had in this law, you see, to shame and bring humiliation, in essence, and, you know, blacken the face, so to speak, of the brother, even though God did not command him to do it, because God wants him to do it, you know, just by showing love and kindness and mercy to his own brother, because it could have happened to him. But he just created this law to function in this manner. And God knows exactly what he's doing. Sometimes bringing shame on yourself is much worse than other things, including death itself for some people. Especially in societies where honor is extremely, extremely important, because now everybody's going to point the finger at you. And so this is what is being said here. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother unto me. Then the elders of the city shall call him and speak unto him. You see, they cannot command him. The law does not command him. In other words, when God didn't command, no man can command. That's, in essence, the way God made it to be. When a lot of people departed from the law of God, they began to invent commandments on their own. And that's when God says, in vain do you worship me, because you're teaching for commandments, you know, the doctrines of men. You see, your fear of me is taught by the doctrines of men. And people haven't learned that since that time yet. If God hasn't commanded, we should not invent commandments. Now, that's not talking about, you know, rules and regulations in terms of traffic, you know, civil matters, things like that. But it's talking about matters that really count in terms of the nature and the character of God, in terms of sin and righteousness, in terms of holiness, you see. And so this is what they're doing here. All they can do is just talk to him, try to convince him. And if he stand and say, in other words, he refuses, he's stubborn, he's not willing to, and you know, he might have a good reason, he just can't stand that woman. You know, it happens. And he says, I like not to take her. And we see a case like that later on, which, showed a different reason why he wouldn't do it. In the case of Ruth, you see, where her mother-in-law told her, Naomi, you know, there is a relative of ours. So actually, Boaz was saying, you know, there is one actually ahead of me. And so he called him and talked to him about it. And he told him about Ruth, and he was willing to marry her. But then when he heard that he's going to have to dedicate his firstborn, not to himself, but to his relative, you know, he said, oh, no, I can't do it. You know, I'd like my own firstborn, you know, to to succeed me, you see. And so he was willing to forego not only Ruth, but, you know, the property that she had now because of her husband. Well, you know, there it was a different reason. But whatever the reason, God you know, also gives an option, because, you know, sometimes, you know, it might be a very good reason, you see, for people not wanting to do it. And so in other case, this is what happens. This is according to the law of God. In that case, in the book of Ruth, you don't see that happening, because that was a little bit different there. And he just worked the agreement, you know, with Boaz. He worked the deal with him, so there was no need to go through that ceremony in that sense, the exception of letting the elders know about it. You see? And so if the men say, "I like night to take care," you know, for whatever reason, then shall his brother's wife draw nigh unto him in the presence of the elders and loose his shoe. That was sort of a ceremony, which was done from his foot, and spit before him, you know, spit on the ground, and she shall answer and say, "So shall it be done unto the man that does not build up his brother's house." And in societies where people, obviously in the communities and families, when they look down on that, realizing that it's a shame, and not to let somebody's name be blotted out, you know, no memory of him. So actually people would do it, you know, as they walked by that man, they actually spit on the ground. So, you know, it brought a lot of shame on the person, but, you know, if he thought that's better to take that than, you know, to marry somebody that he couldn't, you know, live with, obviously he had to make a decision based on that. So, in either case, you see the mind of God here. And a lot of things, you know, go into this. You think about the emotions, you know, the feelings, psychological pressure, you know, peer pressure, and also the option, you know, in case there is something that he just cannot stand about the woman, whatever it may be. Whichever is the case, when you love your neighbor, you know, when you love your brother, when you love anybody as yourself, generally speaking, you would be willing to do it, because after all, you're not losing your own property, just, you know, the firstborn is named after your brother, you see. And in a society, on the other hand, where a firstborn was extremely, extremely important, obviously some people just couldn't bring themselves to do it, to lose their own son, because he's not going to be called by them, but he's still their own son, you see. So it's, you know, it's an emotional decision, very tough one, and that's why God, knowing human nature, knowing weaknesses of man, he still allowed them a way out, but nevertheless not without indignities, not without shame, you see. Because on one hand, he showed them through this law that he wants them to do it. On the other hand, if they've got a weak heart, or whatever might be even a good reason, he allows them a way out, but still, a measure of penalty is going to be paid there. And that's the nature of God. And how would you put on the mind of Christ unless you do this, unless you know this, you see? All these laws here. It's an awful lot, an awesome amount of the mind of God that is totally gone and lost to those who call themselves followers of Christ, because they reject the law of God, the law of Moses. You see? Because he's not about to repeat all these things when he came in the flesh. It was already there. He was teaching from it. He was magnifying it. And he was telling everybody, "Don't think that I came to do with it." Now look how much darkness and ignorance is in the heart of men, thinking that they are in the light, that they are, and other people of Jesus, that they gave their heart to the Lord. You see? It's a horrible shame there. Anyway, we go to another law here. Verse 11, when men strive together, one with another, not two women, are striving together, it could be brothers, relatives, uncles, whatever it may be, that generally it was done within the family, but even if it's not, you know, society develops into a city way of life, and, you know, you don't know necessarily a next-door neighbor in the sense that he's not one of your relatives. Obviously, you know him. It's not like today where you don't. But a couple of men, you know, get, whatever reason, into an altercation, and God is now, in other words, he's covering every possible situation in the life of his people. And mind you, a lot of these things have to do with carnality, you see, because people that live in accordance to the law of God, a lot of things, these things would not even happen. But God has to deal with people the way they are and bring them to his level. as it says, be you holy as I'm holy, be you perfect as I'm perfect, be you righteous as I'm perfect, you know, righteous, you know, put on godliness, that is my nature. You see, a lot of people talk about this terminology and don't even know what it is, you know, it's just have an ethereal concept of it. Yet he specified, you know, in very plain words what it means. And when people reject it, how are they going to have godliness or holiness or righteousness? If they just have a little bit of it, you know, that they read in a certain section, instead of putting the whole thing together and having the whole man, you see, you will never be able to have the fullness of the measure of the stature of Jesus Christ unless you study everything that he said. That's what he said, men shall live by every word that proceeded out of the mouth of God. And if he is your God, what about this statement? You see, a lot of people would rather live in darkness than come out of their holes, you know, and live in the light, in brilliance of light. And so, that's what God is saying here, that's what Jesus Christ is saying here, that's his law, and it does not change. When men strive together one with another, and the wife of the one draws near to deliver her husband out of the hand of him that smites him, well, you know, that's understandable, that's not the issue, God doesn't have anything against this woman for trying to do that, but he says, if she puts forth her hand and takes him by, in Hebrew, the way Christ spelled it, the way God spelled it, is the testicles, mevushav. I did not even use the word testicles, actually, here in Hebrew, mevushav. It comes from the word, which is very interesting, because testicles, you see, would be testicles. But in this case, use the euphemism for it that the society use, which is mevush. Mevush comes from the word to ashamed. You see, bosh, ashamed, lead by esh, to be, you know, to be ashamed. And so this is an area that once upon a time when Adam and Eve, you know, were clean and pure, they were not ashamed. And then when they sinned against God, you see, then they were ashamed of the sexual region and they covered it. And so since that time, that euphemism began to be applied to it, you know, the shameful part, you see, the part, and so the mevush, that's basically in essence what it was. And so if she holds him by that, you see, what do I mean by that? You know, she holds him by the testicles, because, you know, a lot of people know this is a very sensitive, very painful, in other words, if you squeeze it, part of the body of men, and a lot of women are taught to do it, you know, when they're being attacked, you see, because that paralyzes the man, and that's in essence what this woman is doing. I mean, she has no strength against the man, yet she knows, and she goes for Achilles' heel, so to speak, you know, the weak spot, and this way she can at least do something. And yet God says, don't ever do that. And so, look how God feels about it, look how Christ feels about it, and that's the nature of God. And so he said, if she puts forth her hand and takes him by the secrets, well, in English it's put secrets because, you know, King James language, you know, Victorianism, Puritanism, they were purer than God. They were not about to mention things about what they really are, so they invented euphemism that is far even away from the real meaning of it. You know, they use nakedness for erva, and erva means, you know, the pubic area of a person, you know, man or woman. And so they just said nakedness, which does not convey it, you know, because, you know, you can be half naked, you know, from the waist up, you see. And for that, the word is a different word, arom, you see. But, you know, they use nakedness, and in this case, they use secrets, you know. People have got secrets in their pants, and, you know, it's very silly when you think about it. And that's the way man is. And so, in verse 12, we read, well, this is what she does, this is going to be the punishment, and this is the verdict of God. It's not the verdict of Moses, it's not the administration of men, you know. It's not the administration of the old harsh monsters some people call, thinking this is the Father, you know, the God of Israel. No, this is Jesus Christ. He's the King of Israel, he's the husband, he's the lawgiver, and it's the very law, obviously, of the Father. You see, because they're both the same. They think alike. That's their law, their nature. But people should not, you know, have a dichotomy here, you know, between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament. That's the same person. That's an awful lot of ignorance on the part of many. And a lot of them, you know, have PhDs after their name. They are just as blind as a bat and ignorant. And they can be all the way to the top, you know, in terms of the religion, and still utterly ignorant and blind about basic truth. So this is what Christ is saying here. If she does that, then you shall cut off her hand. Your eye shall have no pity. Imagine that. You see, if someone have done it, and actually this is, was done to them, that's a horrible thing. But on the same hand, the same way, you know, same hand, you know, by the same token, think about it. How many women are going to do it if they know that this is going to be the punishment? You see? Well, you might say, well, why so harsh? You see? Well, who gave this law? God gave this law. He's the life giver. And if he feels that it is such a horrible thing to be done, it's up to him to determine that. And who are we, the clay, to judge him? Of course, people like to do it, be it men or women, especially the humanist. You know, we like to point the finger and accuse God, because we're more righteous in our own eyes than he is. We're more merciful, more compassionate. You see? That shows you what kind of a nature is in us when we think that way. Now, that's one of those things that, you know, the devil is going to point at God, you know, and try to convince man, look at what kind of an evil God you have, you know, why don't you worship me, you know, I'm better than he is, and more kind, and that's the spirit that gets into those people that speak evil against God. That's what God says. This is what you do, your hand is going to be cut off, just like if he said, you know, if you murder someone, you'll be murdered. You see, if you kidnap someone, you'll be put to death. Sin is a transgression of the law, and the wages of sin is death. You see, we are not the creator. We're not the author of morality. We're not the author of law and of truth and of judgment or of anything. You know, we're total parasites in one sense when you think about it. We haven't created anything and we use everything. And a lot of people in their audacity, you know, have the audacity to claim, you know, there is no creator. Well, that's insanity on our part. But when we are obedient to the law of God to begin with, we'll never do it, so that would not be applicable in that sense, you know. The law is not applicable to the righteous, as the Apostle Paul said, you know. The law was not made for the righteous. If you're a righteous person, you would realize that God says this part of the body that he created is an awesome part of the body, and it brings life. You see? And, you know, the woman can create damage where the person cannot bear children anymore after that. You know, it's possible. But and that's a horrible humiliation on the man also, you see. So God said, don't ever do that, you see. These are the feelings of God. You have a choice. You either live by them or you go somewhere else. And, you know, it's very simple. And so that's what God says. That's the way you do. No pity. A lot of things for which God has no pity, no mercy, especially people who have no mercy on others. And so verse 13, you shall not have in your bag, that's another law, a diverse weight, a great and small. The society unfortunately functions like that. Cheating is everywhere. Deceiving is everywhere. The fine print is basically that. It's a transgression of this very law. Where in big letters they tell you something to deceive you, to lure you, you know, to get you to buy it or do whatever, you see. But in fine print they say just the opposite. That's a transgression of this very law. And yet society functions like that. You see? It's very unfortunate. And yet people are of that nature, of that spirit. And yet these are the very people oftentimes that have the audacity to accuse God of being an old harsh monster. And God says, don't do that. And, you know, he mentions that when you go to the last eight chapters of Ezekiel, when God speaks about the millennium, you know, the reign of the Messiah, the King of Israel, of Jesus Christ, you see, he mentions that again. He mentions, you know, the amount, you know, the nature of the money, the monetary system. He determines that. He didn't leave it up to man, you see. He talks about the shekel and the gerah and the 20 gerahs and a shekel and so forth. And, you know, the English copied it a little bit. They have the shilling, the 20 pence. And it talks about the weight also. It's extremely important because in the society, unfortunately, of God, where they should have known better, they have transgressed this law oftentimes, and he oftentimes mentions that through the prophets. that were deceiving one another doing that. And they're doing it to this very day. A lot of the market is based on that, unfortunately. Not all of it, but a lot of it. There's an awful lot of corruption out there. There are companies, there are corporations that live on deception in many ways. You see, and God forbids that, because that's wickedness. That's of the devil, and that's not of God. That's against the law of coveting. You see, that's just the opposite. That's stealing and coveting and desiring that which is not yours. And by deception, people do it. So, you know, they're still, you know, you go to many countries. I remember when I was a kid, you know, that system was still there. You have those balances and weights, and you put, you know, 20 grams, 50 grams, 100 grams, you know, a kilo, whatever, you know, in iron. You know, that's what they use there. And put it on one side and then merchandise on the other. But, you know, a lot of people are oftentimes deceived. You know, you thought that what they put there was the right amount. God says, don't ever do that. And he says, they shall not have in your bag diverse weights. You know, you go to the market, you know, do business righteously. A great and a small, you shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small. So anywhere you do business, don't ever steal, don't ever cheat, don't ever rob. And that's the way they used to do it, deceive people. He says, a perfect and just weight shall you have, a perfect and just measure shall you have. So the weight would be for like fruits and things like that, and measure would be for oil, you know, liquids and, you know, other things like that. And God says, either way, you make sure that it is perfect. Be you perfect as I am perfect. And so your balances shall determine and demonstrate whether you are perfect with God or whether you are not. And if it's not, you're a thief, you're a robber, and you're not working perfectly with God. So this law is, if anybody says, you know, the law is done away with, what are they saying? Is it okay to cheat, to rob, to defraud, to deceive? Is that what they are saying by that? You see the insanity in those people when they talk like that? And so they don't even bother to study the law of Moses, to know the mind of, you know, Jesus Christ, the nature, the character, how to be righteous, how to be holy, and so forth. You see, think about it when you study this kind of a law. That's a perfect law. And that's what he's saying here. A perfect and just weight shall you have, a perfect and just measure shall you have. Why? That your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God gives you. Because when you begin to cheat and rob, what happens in the society? You see, you end up with chaos and anarchy and revolution and bloodshed, and people, you know, get, you know, catch you cheat, you know, they'll kill you. You see, it happens. People don't like to be deceived. And so, you know, some person who comes with a sword, you know, and he walks around, you know, if a soldier, you know, and he buys something from you, or just anybody, and he notices that you have cheated him, you know, he might get so angry that he's going to whack your head off. God says you want to live long life, you know, good life, righteous life, behave yourself. That's what he's saying here. Because otherwise, he said, obviously, you're not going to have a long life. And to begin with, God is going to punish you, and finally he's going to throw you out of the land, which he did. And this is one of the reasons for it. Verse 16, for all that do such things, even all that do unrighteously, are an abomination to the Lord your God. So you can go through the entirety of the community in terms of government, in terms of the business community, in terms of advertising, in terms of lawyers, in terms of the fine print. And God looks at that and he says, all that is an abomination to me. And since the God of heaven and earth, in absolute charge of all things, he's going to determine the time and the manner in which he's going to smack anybody. You see? Either individually, which he does. That's why you've got a lot of problems all around. Be it sickness and disease and accidents and calamities and ups and downs in the economy. Or the ultimate, you know, war and captivity. You see? And people are not afraid of God. God says, this is an abomination unto the Lord your God. And this is what people should be teaching everywhere. And because, you know, the church, so-called the church, has failed to do it, the synagogue has failed to do it, the land is full of bloody crime. From top to bottom. You see? That's what Moses told them. If you obey these laws and commandments, you know, the whole world will come and say, wow, what a righteous nation it is. What a wise law they have. We want to be like you. And you would be the light of the nations, you see. Well, instead of that, they behave just like them, sometimes even worse than them. You see, to the point that God had to totally throw them out of the country after all the punishments he brought upon them. Well, things have not changed since that time. We are our father's children, unfortunately, in ways that we should not be. Now he switches to something totally different, which is relevant to this very day. And we spoke a lot already about it. I'm not going to repeat much about it. As a matter of fact, the book that I wrote a while back, about 12 years ago, has an awful lot to say about this one. Because, you know, it talks about all the children of Abraham and their history and their fighting and squabbling and the whereabouts today, all of them, and the end result of all that. That's called the Middle East Blueprint for the Final Solution. And so we talked quite a bit there about Amalek. And this thing, you know, is going on to this very day. It's every day on the news. Well, anyway, we're going to read it here now, where God is saying to Israel through Moses, remember what Amalek did unto you by the way as you came forth out of Egypt. They are about to enter the land, and God does not want them to forget that. There are certain things that God is never going to forget. In other words, he's never going to forgive. Because the problem, for one hand, you know, on one hand, is a continuous problem. And on the other, there are certain things that have been so severe in the sight of God that God is never going to forgive until he takes care of the matter. And this is what he's saying here about Amalek. And he says, remember what Amalek did unto you by the way as you came forth out of Egypt, how he met you by the way and smote the hindmost of you, all that were enfeebled in your rear. When you was faint, you know, old English, washed, when you were faint, in other words,